Sir David King is the chief scientist for the United Kingdom. On November 20, 2006, he gave this speech, Climate Change, Global Solutions for an International Problem. This is part one of two.
Tonight's lecture is Climate Change, Global Solutions for an International Problem. It's the second in the Ralph Miliband series on global risks in the 21st century. I started the series off about 2 weeks ago with a rather pessimistic account of where we are today, and facing a number of key challenges, and set forth something of a paradox that the problems we face are increasingly global, and yet the means we have for addressing them are local, national, weak, and have been damaged over the last few years. But we need to move on from that rather sober view and rather pessimistic view, and as I said 2 weeks ago, look at the key global challenges one by one. And there cannot be any more pressing issue than climate change. And it's hard to imagine a more suitable and more significant and better informed speaker than our speaker this evening. Professor Sir David King is Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK Government and Head of the Office of Science and Technology. If that is not enough, he is also an active Professor of Chemistry at Cambridge University, and he combines being Chief Scientific Advisor and being a Professor of Chemistry, something which I think is quite unique. But as I understand it, he didn't take on the role of Chief Scientific Advisor without saying, my condition is that I stay active as a scientist. And he certainly has done. He's had a long and distinguished career, and it will go on, of course, for a long time, marked by many prestigious posts, including Mastership of Downing College, and he's received numerous prizes and recognitions for his work. He has published over 450 papers in scientific journals, including 20 in the past year. When I read that, I checked it two or three times. I looked for the date. This surely was when he was a full-time academic. This must have been about 10 years ago or so. But no, in the last year, 20 papers. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary if you're a full-time academic. It's even more extraordinary if you're doing that in combination with being the UK Chief Scientific Advisor. On top of that, as Chief Scientific Advisor to government, he's not only done the daily work that requires, but has given over 300 lectures related to science and government in various venues throughout the world. So it's an extraordinary contribution. He says in private that he's energized by this, and he clearly must be, or he's on something we don't know yet very much about. We're very fortunate that he's here this evening, so please join with me in giving him a very warm LSE welcome.
David, thank you very much for that. I'm going to start by saying this is actually the first time I've been back here since I was a PhD student based at Imperial College, and I came over here and attended all of Karl Popper's lecture course here, and what a wonderful period that was for me, especially when I stood up and disagreed with him and ended up having a row that lasted a good 45 minutes, which was a very interesting challenge for me at that time. What I'm going to be talking to you about is what David has described as the major challenge. I certainly believe it's not only the biggest challenge facing us as a society today, it's probably the biggest and most testing challenge that our civilization has yet had to face up to. And let me try and then put that statement in context and see if I can get you to agree with me. If we look at the 21st century as distinct from the 20th century, the 20th century was really a century in which science, technology, engineering, medicine, all of those advances led to a very big change in lifespan. Around the world, we now see lifespan anticipated, life expectancy well over 70 for most of the world. And that is all because of the focus and pull-through of those areas of research that have come through to society. The 21st century, we're in a very, very different place. And just to introduce the subject, let me take you through why I make that statement. First of all, in terms of population growth, we know the 21st century is going to see us go from today's 6.4 billion to 8 billion in 2028 and probably around 9 billion in 2050. We may well plateau off at about 9.5 billion just after mid-century. So there's another 50% growth left in the population system. That raises questions about resources on a single planet. It raises very big questions about the environment, infectious diseases within a globalized economic system. We're currently faced with a pandemic flu possible outbreak, and that is actually preoccupying me at the moment. And amongst all of these, I'm saying that climate change is the biggest challenge. So let me take you through why I make that statement. And in order to do that, I'm going to start with the science so that we can all, if you like, start from the same point. And I'm going to hopefully not make any assumptions about your scientific background in making these statements. So what I have here is a very simple picture of the Earth's surface. Earth heated up by sunlight, Earth cooled down by radiation. Great French mathematician Fourier, 1827, looked at this picture and said, well, I should be able to calculate the surface temperature of the Earth, the average surface temperature of the Earth, because I know that if the radiation from the sun was overwhelming the radiation going out back into space, the Earth's temperature would keep heating up, but it's been approximately constant for many hundreds of years, so it must mean that the radiated energy going out is exactly balanced by the sunlight coming in. He also knew that the radiated energy of a body, leaving a body, is very sensitively dependent on its temperature. So what he concluded was the surface temperature of the Earth would heat up in the presence of the sunlight until it gets to that point where radiated energy going out into space exactly balances sunlight coming in. So he calculates the temperature, average temperature of the Earth, and he reaches an answer of minus 15 degrees centigrade, which even for that time, 1827, he thought wouldn't be good enough to get published. And he also realized there was another little problem that his calculation couldn't cope with. He said, what if I should switch off the sunlight? We think of the sunlight streaming in at quite a rate. Switch it off. We'll leave the radiation going back out into space. How fast would the Earth cool down? And he calculated that over 10 hours, the Earth would cool down another 20 degrees centigrade. So in other words, he was saying, because the sunlight is switched off as the Earth rotates, he was saying daytime temperature should be minus 15 and nighttime temperature minus 35. What he had done was calculate the properties of the moon, in other words, a system which has no atmospheric environment. So he then puts back the blue stuff into his equations. But at this point, he doesn't have the information that he needs. The information he needed was to know how much of that radiated energy going out into space is absorbed en route by the atmosphere then acting as a blanket at night and keeping the Earth warmer, and also keeping the Earth warmer during the day. That was the greenhouse effect, 1827. Fourier understood the greenhouse effect. And what he did then, and this got published, was he didn't know the measurement, so he put in a factor alpha, which was the amount of the radiated energy absorbed by the atmosphere, and he, needless to say, with one variable, he managed to get 15 degrees centigrade instead of minus 15 as the average temperature of the Earth. Then we get a British scientist, Tyndall, who comes along and is not satisfied with this variable parameter that Fourier used, and he says, well, we can measure the amount of heat radiated out that is absorbed by an atmosphere. And he took a great tube of atmosphere and he put radiated energy in one end and measured how much came out the other end. And being a very careful British scientist, he first of all cleaned up the atmosphere that he measured on, and he found Fourier's coefficient was zero. And of course, what he had discovered was that in cleaning up his atmosphere, he had removed what we now call greenhouse gases. So what Tyndall discovered when he redid the experiment with the air as it is, he got Fourier's coefficient very precisely. So what he had discovered was that it was the minority gases, not the oxygen and the nitrogen that is the majority of the atmosphere, that provides the greenhouse effect. Today we understand in fine detail why oxygen and nitrogen don't absorb any of that infrared radiation energy going out, and why the bigger molecules absorb it very effectively. So we have Tyndall to thank for picking up on greenhouse gases and understanding that carbon dioxide and water vapor were the key greenhouse gases. Going forward very quickly in time to 1896, we arrive at the important point. where a Swedish scientist, Svante Arrhenius, said, well, we are burning fossil fuels, and if we're burning fossil fuels, we may change the balance of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. What would that do to the average temperature of the Earth? Using Fourier's equations, he then calculated, should we double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, he published in 1896, the temperature would rise, on average, by 5 degrees centigrade. So his conclusion, using Fourier's coefficient as measured by Tyndall and nothing else, these simple equations, he concluded the Earth's temperature would rise by roughly 5 degrees centigrade. Now, let me tell you that when I was in Japan 5 years ago, I organized for the British scientific community to use the largest computer in the world, the Earth Simulator in Japan, to prepare a model to mimic all of this, throwing in absolutely everything, volcanic activity, green matter, the whole lot. It's an enormous computer program. And the answer for a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that emerges from that program is 5 plus or minus 2 degrees centigrade. All right, so the answer is that effectively, by 1896, the physics of the problem had been understood. It's not to say that there aren't important parameters that are still being debated and looked at. One of them is this little white thing here, because most of you will know that if we have a cloudy day, clouds can do one of two things. If they're nice and white and quite high flying, they can reflect a lot of that sunlight straight back out into space, and so they can cool the Earth's surface down. Or at night, they will keep that radiated energy back in, and they will act as an added blanket to the greenhouse effect. So clouds are a complication. Dark clouds, white clouds, we need to know what's forming. And as we emit more carbon dioxide through fossil fuel burning, temperature of the oceans also rise, and that means water vapor goes up. And so one of the tests of these models is the feedback of water vapor pressure going up. It's a positive feedback term. That means the global warming goes faster because of more water vapor coming up. But if that water vapor forms more clouds and there's more rain, you have another complication. We've also been putting a lot of aerosols up into space, into our atmosphere, and aerosols tend to play the effect of reflecting sunlight back out into space. They tend to cool the atmosphere. So there was a volcanic eruption in the 19th century which actually removed a summer in the United States completely, so there was entire crop failure throughout the United States. So this is aerosols scattering sunlight straight back up into space and causing significant cooling. Right, now the next thing is, does 5 degrees centigrade temperature rise matter? Well, the answer is that in terms of the planetary climate system, that is an enormous change. If we look at the difference between an ice age and a warm period, the temperature difference is around 5 to 6 to 7 degrees centigrade. So we're talking about that sort of significance of change. Right, I've just got to explain one more little piece of science, and that is the carbon cycle. Where does this carbon dioxide come from? But a bigger question is the following. We know now that for millions of years, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been remarkably constant. To give you some numbers, it's been roughly between 200 and 270 parts per million for many millions of years, as I'm going to show you in a moment. Why has it been so constant? I believe the answer is to do with a complex aspect of evolution. That evolution has taken place in ecological niches, evolution has taken place in all different parts of the planet in different ways, and it's taking place in different forms. For example, the green matter on the right of this photograph here, and also the living matter that is represented in this room, two-legged, four-legged, or three-legged. We behave totally differently from green matter in the sense that we give out carbon dioxide, green matter takes it in. That atmosphere acts as a connector within which the evolutionary system took place. And that connectivity means that if you have a period when there's too much green matter, it will consume the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and so it itself will run out of carbon dioxide. The reverse is true for us. We can't have too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So there's a kind of symbiosis in the evolutionary process. But at the same time, during evolution, there was something very important happened, which is geological evolution, that a good bit of this matter that is formed, that all living matter contains carbon, was sequestered naturally in the form of oil, coal, and gas reserves. That natural sequestration process got rid of excess carbon from the atmosphere to keep it at a level that was suitable for all types of living systems. And of course, what we've then done very industriously is dig that up as fast as we can and burn it back into the atmosphere, and we've caused a massive change in the carbon dioxide level in our atmosphere for the first time in that many millions of years. Now, let me just come to what is absolutely amazing in this field is the number of top quality scientists that have moved into it. Every week, new papers are being published that move on the level of understanding. I used to talk about 5 years ago about what the level of carbon dioxide was in our atmosphere going back 200,000 years. I can now tell you that from a very recent paper in the top of the slide, we have information going back 60 million years. Now, you could ask, well, where do we get this information from? Well, if you go to the Antarctic, for example, snow has been falling every winter in the Antarctic. It comes down in layers. You can count the layers if you take an ice core, and it's like counting rings on trees. And so you can count the years from the layers. And the net result is you can count back from ice cores in the Antarctic, you can count back quite accurately about 850,000 years now. The longest ice core that's been measured is 3 kilometers long. It's taken quite a bit of time to measure it all up. Contained in that, then, right at the bottom of the ice core, is a snowfall that fell 800,000 years ago, and it contains little bubbles of gas that represent the atmosphere that existed at that period of time. Another way to do it is from ocean sediments. So you can take cores of sediments or you can take cores of ice. Whichever you take, the agreement between the data sets is absolutely remarkable. Right, what I'm just showing you here is this stunning data set going back 60 million years. And what you see is it's actually the isotope of 18 oxygen in the water, which gives us a proxy to the temperature, and I won't take you through that. You'll be pleased to know. But all I want you to know is that temperature goes up on this axis, time across, and I've put time on a semi-logarithmic scale. So if we go back 50 million years, you'll see that the planetary temperature went through a maximum at that point. At that point in time, there was no ice left on the planet, and if you were thinking of buying real estate, you would have wanted it in Antarctica because that was a tropical forest and the rest of the planet was unbearably hot. So no ice left on the planet. That means that sea levels had to rise because all of the ice that accumulates on land has to end up in the ocean, so the sea level goes up and the ocean warms and expands. And so sea levels were about 150 meters higher at that point than they are now. The map of the world was very different. And at the same time, there in Antarctica, you find large beasts and their remnants are down there underneath the ice. We move from that period, that's the Eocene-Pliocene interface, and we move forward and you'll see that it took about 45, 50 million years for the planetary surface to recover from that very high temperature. Very high temperature, very high carbon dioxide level at that point. And the temperature drops, there's blips and bumps, and we don't know the details of what was happening. And then we move to the present period, and you'll see that we come to the period of mankind. So the evolution of mankind is the last bit of that graph. And by the time we get there, those oscillations are not noise in the data. Those oscillations we have come to call the Ice Age warm period oscillations. So when we hit that period, the Earth has moved into a period of instability in its temperature, and that instability means that we have this phasing of warm periods and ice ages. Now, in the bottom here, I'm just expanding the last bit there, showing the last 400,000 years. And now I'm showing in blue the temperature and in red the carbon dioxide levels. What you see, I'm going to walk away from the mic. The peak here is a warm period. The trough here is an ice age, warm period, and every time we have a a warm period, we see carbon dioxide levels are high. So this is the Fourier effect coming through. We see that when carbon dioxide levels are high, we go into a warm period. Sea levels are changing as the water percolates onto land during an ice age or off from land into the ocean. Sea levels change about 100 meters between an ice age and a warm period. Sea levels are very important precisely because during our period of civilization, we've been building 80% of our cities on coastlines, thinking that coastlines were pretty stable. I come to the last 12,000 years, and I'm going to again walk over. That's the period here of our current warm period. So that's the period, it's the longest lasting warm period, and at the same time, it's the period of our civilization, that's 12,000 years. We came out of the last ice age, we began to come out about 18,000 years ago. So 12,000 years, we have a relatively constant temperature period. But that's unusual if you look back over this period. Now, the top curve, you see that sudden steep rise in red on the right-hand side. Zero is today. That's the sudden steep rise. Is carbon dioxide going up? Remember I said carbon dioxide levels were between 200 and 260 parts per million for the last many millions of years. And now suddenly we're up at, just to give you dramatically today's figure, 383 parts per million. So we're at 383 parts per million today, and that figure is rising at 2 parts per million per annum. So that's the nature of the problem. If you want to ask, how far do I have to go back in time before I get to that level of carbon dioxide, it's roughly where that purple line is, 3 million years. And you can see that already the planetary temperature was quite a bit higher than today. So what we're saying is we've effectively done enough to our atmosphere to switch off the cycle of ice age to warm period, and we're heading into the first hot period for probably 45 million years. That's what these graphs are telling us. The big question is, what is the impact going to be on us as we move through the coming centuries? And that's where I'm now going to take you. If we look at impacts, I want to explain that actually we're already experiencing these impacts. We had a hot summer in Central Europe in 2003. It's the hottest summer on record, which probably isn't saying very much, and you'll see in a moment that it was a severely hot summer. But the important thing is, it's not only the hottest summer, it's the biggest single natural disaster in Central Europe on record, measured by the number of fatalities. Also the biggest natural disaster that's gone unrecorded as a natural disaster, because it played out over a period of about 6 weeks. 32,000 people lost their lives during the summer of 2003 in Central Europe. Now, if we analyse that summer, we can do it in a non-timescale form, and here I'm just doing it by representing a vertical line for every average summer temperature in Central Europe going back to 1863. And the summer of 2003 is clearly unusual. There's a Gaussian curve drawn through the data without including the 2003 summer. What does that mean? It means it's five, for those of you who understand statistics, it's 5.2 standard deviations from the mean. That means it's a 1 in 1,000 year event. Now, most of us would say that's therefore an event that isn't going to happen. Now, the alternative way to look at this is to take a timeline through it. And the timeline demonstrates that actually over that period of the last 50 years, the temperature rise we've experienced has been around 0.7 degrees centigrade in Central Europe. And that baseline temperature increase, the average temperature increase, means that when we get a hot summer, it's sitting on an already higher baseline. And another way of saying that is that the present average temperature in the 21st century in Central Europe, and this century is only 6 years old, is now roughly the same as the hottest summer of the 20th century, that summer of 1947 that you see on the right-hand side in blue there. So let me repeat that. The average Central European summer temperature is now the same as the hottest summer of 1947. So that means when we get a hot summer now, on top of that 1947 hot summer, we experience a lot of pain. This means it's no longer possible for climatologists to talk about an event as a one-in-a-thousand-year event because of that timeline change. Right, so the analysis indicates that half of the severity of that summer in terms of the temperature rise can be attributed to the global warming that's already occurred, but most of the fatalities, because it's that excess heat that has produced the fatalities. Right, so what does the modelling say that we have ahead of us? So as we now stretch forward in time, and I'm now taking the models that I was discussing before, running on the Earth simulator. These are massive pieces of work. And extrapolating forwards, I've got a pale blue curve and I've got a dark blue curve. Of course, what we've got to know is what is the global behaviour going to be about carbon dioxide emissions. So as we go forward in time, we could either say business as usual, we keep burning all of that coal and gas and oil that we need to energise our societies, and then we stay on the pale blue curve, or we get some global agreement to reduce emissions over the coming years and manage to terminate with an atmosphere containing about 550 parts per million. Now, if you remember, I said 270 parts per million was the normal warm period level, so this means we're actually going to have to bust a gut to be at something like twice the normal level for a warm period. That's what that blue curve is showing, and that blue curve is indicating a 4 degree centigrade temperature rise, average planetary temperature rise. Now, the interesting thing here is that the carbon dioxide level has increased so quickly in our atmosphere over the last 50 to 100 years, and particularly in the last 50 years, that it's going to take another 30 years for the climate system to catch up. So the next 30 years of temperature rise, which would take us up to somewhere around here, the next 30 years of temperature rise are in the pipeline anyway. So whatever we do in terms of global action is actually going to only pay through into these graphs in the later part of this century. That's one of the big political challenges I'm referring to. Is it possible for us to make a political decision to act on something now when the change that we're trying to engineer will only happen 40 or 50 years in the future? That's the first of the big challenges. You'll see that the temperature rise around the planet is not anticipated to be even, and as a matter of fact, these models are extremely impressive. They give you a temperature rise down to a 60 by 60 kilometre pixel scale. So we've got the whole planet predicted down to a 60 by 60 kilometre scale. Now, this is one run of one model with one set of parameters fed into it. And your next question would be, so how reliable is that? So now we go back to a probabilistic analysis, and I promise after this it all gets a bit easier. A probabilistic analysis which just says, what is the probability if the ultimate carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, for example, the one curve in blue, was to be at 450 parts per million, what will the average temperature rise of our planet be? You take that 450 million, you can see that the most probable increase is about 2.2 degrees centigrade. I've said we've already had 0.7 degrees, so there's still a significant temperature rise ahead of us, even at 450 parts per million. But the probabilistic analysis then shows on a 5% to 95% basis, we're talking about 1.5 to almost 4 degrees centigrade on a 450 parts per million level. And then as we increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere up to the orange curve, 750 parts per million, the most probable temperature rise is heading towards 5 degrees centigrade. 750 parts per million isn't randomly chosen here. By the end of the century, business as usual, we will pass 750 parts per million. There's enough coal for us to burn to take carbon dioxide levels probably up to about 2,000 parts per million. So if we really try hard, we can push the planetary temperature up very substantially. What are the consequences of all of this? Well, as we move these models forward to the 2080s, we can first of all see what happens in terms of sea level rise. So these curves are just showing what happens in terms of sea level rise, and you'll see that parts of our planet where the effect is greatest are very much around India and Asia, and the African continent as well. And the number of people displaced from their normal place of abode because it would no longer be possible to live there is roughly indicated here. But certainly, by that time, hundreds of millions of people will have had to move from their normal place of abode. Now, I would suggest that that would be a massive geopolitical destabilization and economic destabilization, because those people would be moving to other areas which are more habitable but which would already be occupied. And I don't think any one of us would be free of the consequences of that process. I would also, just at this point, interject and say that I do believe that Darfur is arguably a climate change conflict. The changes that are happening in northern Africa in particular, but it's beginning to happen in southern Africa, we're seeing increased desertification, which is again predicted by these detailed models. And that desertification means that crop failure becomes routine and people start clamoring to move, and as they start moving, they're moving to already occupied areas. What is the point at which most of us feel we should not test the climate change models? And we've come up with a single icon, and that is ice on Greenland. So if we forget everything else and just concentrate on ice on Greenland, why is that important? Well, again, Greenland's been accumulating ice for thousands of years, and if all of the Greenland ice were to melt, and regarding nothing else, just the melting of Greenland ice going into the ocean, the sea level rise around the world would be 6.5 meters. And of course, at 6.5 meters sea level rise, we would certainly not only lose London, but we'd lose all of the major coastline cities around the world. They would become indefensible at that level. People tend to think of a sea level rise and then measure where that would mean, but don't forget it's actually storms at sea that determine how close you can live to the actual sea level.
Sir David King is the chief scientist for the United Kingdom. On November 20th, 2006, he gave this speech, Climate Change, Global Solutions for an International Problem. This is part one of two.